Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Dvaita Gadadhara Harshivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai. Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gaura Gopinath Sarva Kunda Radha Kunda Kiri Gaura Dham Ki Jai. Vrindavan Dham Ki Jai. Mathura Dham Ki Jai. Navadvipa Mayapur Dham Ki Jai. Jagannathpuri Dham Ki Jai. Gangamaya Jamuna Devi Ki Jai. Bhakti Devi Ki Jai. Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai. Samaveta Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai. Gaura Premananda. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Guranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada Nama Om Vishnu Padaya. Krishna Vrsnaya Bhutale Sri Mati Bhakti Vinata Swamiti Namini. Namaste Saraswati Deva Gauravani Bhutani Vasasas and Nani Paskatyanda Sitarani. Vande Hum Sri Guru Sri Jampad Kamalam Sri Guru Vaishnavam Sri Shri Rupam Sadhvajatam Sakhna Raghunatam Vitam Stam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvajutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Deva Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitam Stam Panchakam Pachuvishtam Kipasni Yavatam Kitanam Pamadeva Vajri Vimama Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
October 21st, 2016, in Cape Town, South Africa. We're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 10, Departure of Lord Krishna from Dwarka, Text 2. Sutuvacha Vamsa Kurur Vamsa Davagni Niritam Samro Hayitva Bhava Bhava No Hari Neveshayitva Nija Raja Ishwaro Yudhisthiram Pritamana Babuvaha Sutta Uvacha. Sutta Goswami replied. Bhamshan, dynasty Kuruhol of King Kuru, Bhamsha Dava Agni, a forest fire set by the bamboos. Niritam, exhausted. Samrohayitva, seedling of the dynasty. Bhava Bhavanaha, the maintainer of creation. Harihi, the personality of Godhead Sri Krishna. Neveshayitva, having reestablished Nijaraje in his own kingdom, Ishwaraha, the Supreme Lord, Yudhisthiram, unto Maharaj Yudhisthira, Pritamanaha, pleased in his mind, Babhuvaha, became. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Sutta Goswami said, Lord Sri Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is the maintainer of the world, became pleased after reestablishing Maharaj Yudhisthira in his own kingdom and after restoring the Kuru dynasty, which had been exhausted by the bamboo fire of anger. So what pleased the Lord here?
Establishing Maharaj
Yudhisthira and? Restoring the Kuru dynasty. So those two things gave pleasure to the Lord. Purport. This world is compared to a forest fire caused by the cohesion of bamboo bushes. So we have, you know, some Sanskrit that reminds us of something we sing every day. Yes, exactly. Such a forest fire takes place automatically, for bamboo cohesion occurs without external cause. Similarly, in the material world, the wrath of those who want to lord it over material nature interacts, and the fire of war takes place, exhausting the unwanted population. Wow, what a sentence. Should I read that again?
Yes.
What? What? There's so much packed into that one sentence. Similarly, in the material world, the wrath of those who want to lord it over material nature interacts, and the fire of war takes place, exhausting the unwanted population. So people want to lord it over material nature, and that fills them with what? Wrath. Why? Because they're frustrated, because they can't lord it over material nature. Right? They want to do something they can't do. And then what happens to this wrath? It interacts, because everybody has wrath that they can't exploit the material nature. Right? Every conditioned soul wants to lord it over material nature. So they're all full of not just anger, but this is wrath. This is extreme anger. Why can't I lord it over the material nature? And that interacts. Why does it interact?
Friction.
Yeah, there's friction. But what does that mean? The wrath of one, of those who want to lord it over material nature interacts.
They're competing for the same resources.
Exactly. They're competing for the same resources, and therefore they direct their wrath at each other. By the way, we also direct this wrath at our own bodies and mind, which is the source of all of our disease and anxiety, 100%. And we also exert this wrath against material nature itself, which is why we pollute the earth and destroy the earth and so forth. And we also have this wrath ultimately against Krishna. So, you know, why can't I lord it over material nature? It must be his fault, her fault, right? Or it must be the fault of my body, or it must be the fault of my mind, or it must be the fault of just nature itself, or it must be the fault of God. And this is where we get all of our suffering from. 100% is our anger at not being able to control. And from this interaction of wrath, what takes place? War, particularly war. So we were talking about, because this is in the context of this verse, is about war. So war, and then what does war do? It has something positive that it does. It gets rid of the unwanted population. Okay. Going on. Such fires or wars take place, and the Lord has nothing to do with them. So Krishna is not responsible for the fact that our wrath and wanting to lord over the material nature causes wars or altercations or misunderstandings or difficulties with other living entities, causes us disease and anxiety, causes us to destroy our environment, and causes us to have a difficult relationship with the Lord. He has no responsibility for that one whatsoever. Okay, he has nothing to do with it. But because he wants to maintain the creation, he desires the mass of people to follow the right path of self-realization, which enables the living beings to enter into the kingdom of God. The Lord wants the suffering human beings to come back home, back to him, and cease to suffer the threefold material pains. The whole plan of creation is made in that way. So Krishna does have some interest in this. He's not responsible for the situation. He's nothing to do with it. But he has some interest. What's his interest? He wants to maintain the material creation for the purpose of bringing the living entities back to him. So he has some interest in what's going on, because he wants people to stop suffering. He has nothing to do with the fact that we're suffering. He has no responsibility for that whatsoever, zero. But he wants it to stop. He's compassionate. You know, generally, if we have nothing to do with something, we don't care if it stops or not. But although he has nothing to do with the fact that they're suffering, that we're suffering, he wants it to stop. He wants the living entities to come to their joyful position. The whole plan of creation is made in that way, and one who does not come to his senses suffers in the material world by pangs inflicted by the illusory energy of the Lord. So here it's saying the illusory energy is inflicting the pangs, but actually we are inflicting the pangs, as it says in Bhagavad Gita. The living entity is the cause of their suffering and enduring. The Lord therefore wants his bona fide representative to rule the world. Why? How will that help? People being on the right path. Yes, Lord Shri Krishna descended to establish this sort of regime and to kill the unwanted persons who have nothing to do with his plan. So Krishna wants to get rid of people who are interfering with his plan. Therefore, he has some interest in the wars that take place automatically and end up doing that. So I said, yes, okay, good. If the wars are going to take place automatically, let's use the facility of the war to get rid of the people who are causing the disturbance. The battle of Kurukshetra was fought according to the plan of the Lord. So here again, the Lord has nothing to do with the wars that occur because of our wrath and not being able to lord it over the material nature. But he uses that to facilitate his plan of getting rid of the troublesome people and putting the people he wants in charge. The battle of Kurukshetra was fought according to the plan of the Lord so that undesirable persons could get out of the world. And hey, we would always like to do that with our life, right? Get the undesirable people out of our world. And a peaceful kingdom under his devotee could be established. The Lord was therefore fully satisfied when King Yudhisthira was on the throne and the seedling of the dynasty of Kuru in the person of Maharaj Prakrit was saved. Sutta Uvacha, Vamsam Kuru Vamsha Devagni Niritam Sambro Hayit Va Bhava Bhava No Hari Nevesha Yit Va Nija Rajo Ishvaro Yudhisthiram Prita Mana Bhavu Vaha. Sutta Goswami said, Lord Shri Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is the maintainer of the world, became pleased after re-establishing Maharaj Yudhisthira in his own kingdom and after restoring the Kuru dynasty, which had been exhausted by the bamboo fire of anger. What time do we stop? Nine? That one? So I think we can say that everyone, even the atheists and the demons, in one sense want to align themselves with Krishna's plan. And even somebody who's an atheist, a demon in the mode of ignorance, they want their plans to work out, correct? Everybody wants their desires, their plans to work out. So everybody wants their plans aligned with what's going to work out. Now those in the mode of ignorance don't think of it like that. They don't think of there's some universal plan, there's a universal controller, and if I get my plans aligned with him, then it's more likely to work out. But they think in terms of luck, and circumstance and fortune and that kind of thing. Proper timing. Although they think Ahankarami Bhutamakar Dhami Kimanyate, they think that they are the controller of all that, but they still have some plan like that. And those in the mode of ignorance, they want their plans to align with what's going to work out. And their motive is so they can achieve what they want with the least possible effort. Because that's the mood in the mode of ignorance, that I'm going to make the least effort possible to get what I want. Therefore, those in the mode of ignorance are not particularly concerned about consequences. They're concerned with immediate satisfaction, and they'll worry about the consequences later, is how they think about it. You know, let me just eat fast food that I can, you know, I can go to the restaurant and I can order it and it's ready in 2 seconds, which means it's all full of preservatives and chemicals and things like that. And whatever happens with my health later, I'll worry about that later. You know, they're just immediate gratification. Now, those in the mode of passion, they want their plans to align with the plans of the Lord so that they can conquer material nature effectively. The personification of passion, of course, is the what? Raja means passion, also means king. So the king embodies this mode of passion. And the mode of passion is mostly pious persons. They're people who believe in God. Most religious systems in the world today promote the mode of passion. Be a good, you know, husband, be a good wife, be a good citizen, take care of things, be righteous for the glory of God and in the service of God. But their main idea is that God is going to sanction or approve or facilitate their plans. They're primarily seeing God as an order supplier. So they're thinking, if I can get my plans in sync with God's plans, then I'll get whatever I want in the world. And we've seen this, it's in the context of war, where people fight wars and everybody claims that God is on their side. I think there was a famous song like that, some folk song like that. You know, that each side says God is on their side. I mean, right now we have a war going on the planet between the radical Muslims and pretty much everybody else. You know, the radical Muslims and the non-radical Muslims and the radical Muslims and the Christians and the radical Muslims and the Jews and the radical Muslims and the Hindus and the radical Muslims, whoever you are. And everybody thinks God is on their side. You know, the Christian countries, they say, we're really fighting for God, these people are devils, right? Isn't it? And then the radical Muslims are saying, we're fighting for God, these people are devils. You know, of course they don't remember history, that there was a time when the Christians were the radical terrorists, right? And the Muslims were trying to defend themselves against the radical terrorist Christians, or the indigenous people of the world. were trying to defend themselves against the radical terrorist Christians, or the Protestant Christians were trying to defend themselves against the radical Catholic terrorists, like the Spanish Inquisition and things like that. So this is going on, and at any particular moment, people will say, our side has God on our side, we're the ones who are right, you're the evil person, and so forth and so on. So this is very much the mode of passion, and that we think basically God is arranging everything for me. If I want to have a picnic, God has made it sunny for my picnic. Ridiculous. And then those in the mode of goodness, they want their plans to be in harmony with God so that they'll find inner peace. They're not so much interested in conquering the world. Now all these, ignorance, passion, and goodness, they all want to lord it over material nature. A person in the mode of ignorance wants to lord it over material nature by doing what's the easiest, most expeditious thing, regardless of the consequences for them and for others. How they can easily get pleasure and get rid of pain. That's basically there. You know, how I can be happy without getting out of bed, kind of thing. And if I can be happy by just taking some drug or, you know, alcohol or something, then I'll do that. Why should I bother to work for happiness, right? Just drink it. So that's their way of trying to control the material world in the mode of passion. They want to control the material world by their plans and their, you know, their enterprises and their righteousness. And the mode of people, the mode of goodness, they want to conquer the material world by controlling their mind and their senses and becoming into inner peace and getting into equal balance. And this way they'll be able to live happily in the world. So they figure if I align my plans with God, then I'll be peaceful because I won't be wanting something that's outside of harmony with the universe, because that's what they're looking for. They're looking for inner harmony with the universe. Now those in bhakti, it's very interesting why those in bhakti want to align their plans with the plans of the world. I'm going to say it's very interesting because I found in the Hare Krishna movement not so much ignorance, I mean, there's some bhakti and mode of ignorance, but I find a lot of passion and goodness. I find a lot of times devotees think the reason we want to align our plans with Krishna's plans is so our plans will work out externally. And that's how they measure Krishna's pleasure also. So if I have a plan to do a certain project in devotion and that plan happens, then they say, oh, that must mean my plan was aligned with the Lord. You understand? Their evidence procedure is whether or not my plan is aligned with the Lord is whether on the external platform what I wanted to happen happens. And the reason they want to align their plan with the Lord is so what they want will happen. That is completely, totally, absolutely Rajagun. That's the mentality of Rajagun. It's very fruitive. I want a particular thing to happen. And if I align myself with God, then it will probably happen. And I have to figure out what God wants. Okay, God wants that to happen. Okay, I'll want that to happen too, and then it will happen. You follow? Yes? It's very external based. It's measuring your bhakti by externals, which Jiva Goswami says is the result of inattentive bhakti, inattentive chanting, that we measure bhakti by externals. And we're going to be studying in Manashiksha tomorrow night with verse 7, how Bhaktivinoda Thakur says this is a form of bathing in donkey urine instead of bathing in the ocean of love, that you measure your bhakti by external things. And it's a difficult thing because in this world we tend to measure things by the mode of passion. We're having a discussion right now among the Back to Godhead editors about doing obituaries for devotees. You know, it's always a struggle because our editor-in-chief wants to do as few obituaries as possible. Devotees die, you know, every day some devotees die, and we don't want Back to Godhead to be the magazine of the obituaries of the devotees. And everybody who thinks that everybody who dies went back to Godhead and that they should get an obituary, so it's a little difficult. So who are we going to choose? So we tend to choose people who have very notable external accomplishments. That's who we tend to choose. We don't tend to choose the humble devotee in the background making garlands who may be in Krishna Prema that nobody knows about. Okay? So we tend to choose the people with the external accomplishments in bhakti, and then what do we talk about in the obituary? We talk about their external accomplishments. We're not talking about their inner ecstasies. And so by doing that, we're indirectly telling everybody that the most important people in bhakti are those who have all kinds of external accomplishments. And the most important thing they do is their external accomplishments. How many books did they distribute? How many temples did they build? You know, how much money did they contribute? And so many things. How many rounds did they chant? I know there's a story of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. He met someone in Vrindavan who was chanting 150 rounds a day. The devotee said, oh, he's such an advanced devotee. He says, no, no, he's just a beginner. So, you know, even that is a kind of external. Or I see devotees want to align themselves with Krishna's plan because they figure out that's how they'll get their own inner peace and joy, which is sattva-gun. Now, sattva-gun is good. Okay, we're not putting down sattva-gun because Krishna says in the 11th canto, until you've realized your spiritual identity, you should engage in sattva-gun. So if you're not purely Krishna conscious, sattva-gun is a good place to be. Krishna says so. But even sattva-gun is still egotistical. It's about my peace and my happiness. So, you know, if I am doing what Krishna wants, then I'm just going to feel peaceful and satisfied, regardless of the result. You follow? Like Krishna says to Arjuna, be detached from fame and infamy, honor and dishonor, heat and cold, happiness and distress, right? Okay, if I align myself with Krishna's plan, then even if there's a failure, I'll still be happy. You follow? But that's sattva-gun. Sattva-gun is good. If you're in Rajagun, going to sattva-gun is a big step up. But it's still about me. Now, why do those in bhakti want to align themselves with Krishna's plan? This is really interesting. Their motives are completely different. And their motives, I'm going to say they, since I'm not in bhakti. Jai Krishna, Nittai, Mayapur, Chandra. The motives of those in bhakti, we can understand by looking at a very unusual pastime. And I've just been studying about this pastime, both because I recently finished reading the 11th and 12th canto, and because it's in a section of the Bhagavatam that I'm preparing to teach in Vrindavan at the VIHE. So I ended up kind of going more into this lila than I usually would. And that is about the destruction of the Yadu dynasty, which is, of course, somewhat related, again, to today's verse, the removing of unwanted persons from the earth. In that case, the Yadus were a different kind of burden than, of course, those who died in the battle of Kurukshetra. So, as you know, the members of the Yadu dynasty were told by the Lord to go to Prabhaskshetra and do yajnas there and worship the Brahmanas. That was the instruction of the Lord himself. And when they got there, because the Kshatriyas are allowed to drink alcohol under certain conditions, you know, Narada criticized Vyasadeva for that. He said, why are you allowing sinful activity under certain conditions? It will get out of control. We see in all religious systems, there's things allowed under certain conditions, right? So the Kshatriyas were allowed to drink under certain conditions, and they started drinking alcohol. And when they drank alcohol, they lost their intelligence, which is generally what happens when people drink alcohol, and they became angry, which is a very common result of alcohol, as everyone knows. Right? Anger and violence and alcohol are very closely linked. And in their anger, they picked up some reeds and started hitting each other. Now, normally, that wouldn't have had much of an effect if you just pick up a reed. But because of the curse of the Brahmanas and Sambo with the iron rod and blah, blah, which I'm not going to get into that, the reeds were actually made of iron. And they killed each other. Now, so, okay, you're a Yadu. And let's say you're one of the Yadus and you're a pure devotee. Why do you do this? You do it because it's what Krishna wants you to do. Why does Krishna want you to do it? Because there was no other way to get rid of the Yadus. There's no demon that could kill them. It wouldn't have been very nice if Krishna killed them personally. That wouldn't have been very favorable. So the only way they could die was to kill each other. And he wouldn't have wanted them to commit suicide. How were they going to leave? I guess they could have all left by yogic power. They could have all just sat down in yogic meditation. Like Sati left her body, they could have left their body that way. But Krishna wanted them to destroy each other in this way. He had other purposes, of course. The purpose was also to say that even if you're a Yadu, if you drink alcohol, you may lose it. You know, the same with Yudhisthira. Even if you're Yudhisthira, you gamble, you may lose it. You know, just, hey, don't think, I'm so elevated. I just had a devotee yesterday said, you know, Urmila, one of my good friends, Urmila, would you like to make some money? How? Well, I have an investment for you. What kind of an investment? On the U.S. elections. I said, that's not an investment. I said, that's just gambling. Hare Krishna. So, you know, one may think, oh my God, one may think, well, I'm a devotee. You know, I can gamble or I can drink alcohol or I can, it's okay. So that's one reason Krishna has these activities. He actually, just think about this for a minute, okay? He says to his devotees, would you please do something wrong and make a mess out of things just so I can teach a lesson to people? Think about that for a minute. Would we be willing to do that? If Krishna came and said, listen, I have something for you to do, I have a plan. Oh, Jai, what do you want me to do? You want me to open a big temple and become famous, right? I'll do that. You want me to distribute a million books and they put me at the top of the Sankirtan newsletter. Okay, I'll do that. You want me to just sit at Radhakund and chant, you know, 192 rounds a day and get into ecstasy. Sure, I'll do that. No, that wasn't what I had in mind. But what did you have in mind, Lord? I want you to do something really stupid that's against the regulative principles so everybody can criticize you for the next 5,000 years and you're going to die from it. Do you have anything else on your list of assignments that I could choose from? The devotees agree to do it. Draupadi agrees to be insulted. They agree. They say, Lord, whatever you want me to do. This is not an excuse for psychotic people saying, you know, God told me to drink alcohol. That's not what I'm talking about. But the devotees will agree to do anything in the Lord's pastimes. Anything. And they're not even looking, look, this is really far out. They're not even looking for inner peace, which is Satvagun. Now, of course, in bhakti, you're beyond inner peace. You already have inner peace as far as the mundane world goes. The devotee's anxiety is not, you know, am I going to get sick? Am I going to lose my money? Is my husband going to leave me? That's not the kind of... The devotees are completely equipoised about that kind of stuff. But they have transcendental anxiety. Mother Yasoda is in anxiety about Krishna. She really is. She has genuine fear about Krishna. That if Krishna is allowed to break the butter pot, if he's allowed to act like that, he won't grow very nicely. How will he be a good person? You know, how will he get a job? How will anybody want to marry him? This is the anxiety of all mothers. Correct? I was reading that big Olympic athlete, what's his name? Bolt? Usain Bolt, who actually runs like a bolt. It was interesting that he got that name. So, you know, he won all the, I don't remember exactly, like he won some record number of Olympic medals for running. And he goes to see, the reporters ask his mother, so what do you think about your son who's just won a record number of Olympic medals? And she said, you know, he's getting kind of old, he's not married yet. So Mother Yasoda has this anxiety. You know how if I allow Krishna to be destructive like this, and Krishna got angry that my mother's not feeding me, my mother left me in the middle of feeding me, and in his anger, he was destructive. So you don't want your children to do that. You don't want your children to break things just because they're angry. You say to them, look, you know, I understand you're angry, but let's deal with it in a nice way. And you just say, Mommy, I'm angry, and we'll talk about it, but don't go breaking things, right? Isn't that what you teach your children? So she's worried. She has a transcendental anxiety, and the devotees are willing, not only willing, they're eager to take up even transcendental anxieties. The yadus were willing to become angry at each other, apparently, like what's being talked about here. The materialistic people who in their wrath fight each other and kill each other and get rid of the unwanted person. So the yadus were willing to behave as if like that in order to remove themselves from the earth. Like, okay, Krishna, whatever you want me to do, I'm happy to do. Because they see everything as lila. They know that they can't get hurt. They have complete fearlessness. Absolute complete. There's not a drop of fear for their own self. They have no attachment to anything in the world. They have no dependence on anything in the world for their happiness. Nor are they happy just by being equipoised. I mean, this was a situation with Priyavrata, right? Priyavrata was this equipoised brahmacharya up in the mountains. And he's told, you know, go take on the anxiety of rulership. And he's like, well, I don't really want to lose my equilibrium. No, Krishna wants it. Okay. I'll take on all these anxieties for Krishna. But for the devotees, these anxieties are all ecstatic. Right? There's 12 secondary rasas. One of them is fear, one of them is anger, one of them is heart, one of them is compassion. The devotees are willing to take one of them, you know, compassion is also grief. But these are all varieties of ecstasy. And the devotee is engaging in Krishna's plan. You know, Draupadi, when she's being offended, Yudhisthira, when he's losing the gambling match. The other Pandavas, when their lives are being gambled away to Duryodhana. I mean, of course, that got reversed by Draupadi, but still, I mean, there was some time there. Can you imagine this for a minute. You know, you're sitting there, and your older brother just gambled you away as a slave to your enemy. It was probably at least an hour between the time that happened and the time that Dhritarashtra reversed that by the request of Draupadi. It's a long time to think that you're going to be Duryodhana's slave, that you just went from being the, you know, emperor of the world to the slave of Duryodhana. So the devotees are happily, joyfully, eagerly willing to do that. They're willing to be installed as the emperor of the world and take all that anxiety of Krishna wants, and they're willing to kill themselves, kill each other in Prabhasa, if that's what Krishna wants. They're willing to be humiliated, if that's what Krishna wants. The cowherd boys, when the yogi Brahmas didn't reply, they were humiliated. They were willing to do that. They're willing to be defeated, like Jatayu, if that's what Krishna wants. And they're not just looking for equilibrium in the face of success or failure, they're looking for the happiness of Krishna's pleasure. They're not looking for their own equilibrium, they're looking for the happiness of Krishna's pleasure. That's their happiness, and that's love. And we have some little idea of that in this world, that's love. That if I really, 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 truly love you, I will be willing to do anything for you, including suffering difficulty, suffering defeat, being humiliated, all the things that we are the most terrified of. Right? What are we the most absolutely, totally terrified of? Now, physical disability, physical pain, public humiliation, mental disease, you know, dementia, losing all of our friends. Right? Isn't it? Losing our society. If you put it all in one glob, it would kind of be, we're paraplegic in chronic pain on the side of the road, abandoned by all our families and friends, hoping somebody gives us something to eat. So that would kind of be the encapsulation of all of those fears. But when you have love, you're willing to risk that for the person. You're willing to risk anything. But we see some perversion of this. A person loves their country, and they're willing to risk their physical and mental health. Not only do people literally give their right arm for their country, but they get, what is it, PTSD. They get mental diseases from being, and they're willing to risk that. They know, right? And people will risk everything for someone they love or for some cause they love. And that's their happiness. And of course, materially, it doesn't quite work that way. You know, you risk everything for your country or for your spouse or for your business, and you become disappointed. It was the wrong object. You gave everything to the wrong object, and you'd be devastated. But we get some idea of this. All right, so let's briefly look at what is Krishna's plan and how we can align with Krishna's plan and how Krishna uses everything in his plan. So what is Krishna's plan? Prabhupada says here very succinctly, Krishna's plan is everybody be eternally happy in spiritual consciousness. Krishna's plan is basically happiness. That's a succinct. What is Krishna's plan? Happiness. Prabhupada was asked in South America, why is there anything? Why does anything exist? And Prabhupada's answer was, ananda. The reason anything exists is happiness. Yeah. Krishna will even let you pretend to be happy in a way that you're not. because he wants to facilitate happiness. But his plan is, let me give you real happiness. So, of course, in the spiritual world, everything is overflowing with unlimited, ever-expanding happiness, naturally, because that's a natural effect of love. And in this world, he's trying to get everybody to come to that platform. This is kind of like a drug addiction treatment program. You know, we're all addicted to illusion in one form or another. And Krishna wants us to come to actual happiness of sobriety. So that's his plan. As far as does Krishna have very specific plans about how to accomplish it, it seems that Krishna's plans to accomplish it are ever in flux. That Krishna is very flexible. He's not a very rigid ruler. He doesn't go with the flow. He is the flow. But he's a flow that can go around and over. And, you know, he knows where he's going. Like this, the rivers are going to the sea. He knows where he's going. But he has a variety of ways to get there. And there's a nice story in the Chaitanya Bhagavat which illustrates this. And had I had more time to prepare, I would have arranged to print that out because I don't remember it exactly. But it's something like then when Srivas was being harassed by the Muslim rulers, and Lord Chaitanya says, don't worry, I'll take care of them. Don't be afraid. He says, plan A, I'm the super soul in everyone's heart, and I'll tell the Muslim ruler from in his heart he has to leave you alone and surrender. If that doesn't work, Lord Chaitanya says, then, I always forget step two. I always forget what the other, anyway, another one that he was going to do. He says, if that doesn't work, then I will go with you to the ruler's court, and will ask him, get out your Muslim imams and tell them to put everyone in ecstasy. And then I will get all the humans and all the animals, and I will make them dance in ecstasy. And that will convince him. And then he looks at little Narayani, who's 4 years old, and he said, Narayani, chant in Krishna Prema. And she did. He says, see, don't worry, Srivas. I have it all worked out. But he had three plans. He had plan A, plan B, and plan C. Isn't that interesting? Why? Because he's working with people's free will. If that doesn't work out, I'll try this. If that doesn't work out, I'll try this. So when we say I want to align with Krishna's plan, that doesn't usually mean, okay, Krishna wants me to do exactly this at 9:16 and exactly this at 9:18. And if I just could figure that out. But more, that Krishna wants me to align with his plan of bringing everyone to Krishna consciousness. That's what Krishna wants. So how can we align with Krishna's plan? First of all, in our consciousness, we can raise our consciousness up to at least sattva-guna or to bhakti, where we become conscious of Krishna. And we become genuinely compassionate for others, and we really care about others' happiness. Now, we can even practice this. You can try, like once every hour, look around, find somebody. If there's no one around, do it in your mind. May you become happy. Anyone you meet, may you become happy. It's really quite simple. Just may you become happy. May you become genuinely happy. Well, especially for our so-called enemies. When somebody hurts us, when somebody offends us, when somebody messes up our plans, may you be happy. May you learn whatever you need to. Yes, a lot of things you better learn. May you learn them through happiness. So to wish happiness for others, practice wishing happiness for others. By the way, we should also wish happiness for ourselves. Okay? Self-hatred means we're hating a part of Krishna. Am I Vamsa Jiva Lokaya Jiva Bhutas? And we're a part of Krishna. It's hypocritical to say I want to love Krishna, but I want to hate a part of Krishna. So we know we're not supposed to hate our enemies, but frankly, we shouldn't hate ourselves either. We are a part of Krishna. Therefore, Krishna says one should have Atmarama, Atmatusta, Atmarati. One should love oneself. Said those who are in transcendental consciousness, they relish and rejoice in the self. And the other way Krishna is probably talking about in this purport, to take some responsibility. If we don't do the consciousness thing first, then we'll be taking responsibility in one of the modes. We don't want to take responsibility in Rajaguna or Tamaguna. If you take responsibility in Sattvaguna, that may be okay. But take responsibility in Rajaguna. I am taking responsibility because I am the most qualified. and I am going to do great things because I am great, and I know how to do great things more than anybody else. And so I'm going to do these wonderful, great things. Get out of my way while I do all my great things for Krishna. And Tamagun is, I'm going to take responsibility because that way I get the best room in the temple and I get the Mahaprasadam. And I get an easy life if I take some responsibility. And I'll just take responsibility. I'll just take the title in Tamagun. You just want the title, but you don't actually do anything. You follow what I'm saying? You know, I'm the minister, be the minister of cow protection, but it won't protect any cows. I'll just take the title and that kind of thing. Right? So we take some responsibility for Krishna. And it's very nice. I really like one quote from Srila Prabhupada's godbrother, B.R. Sridhar Maharaj, where he says that when you take responsibility for Krishna, automatically you're engaging your mind in that responsibility, and it's a really good way to control the mind. Srila Prabhupada said something very similar when he said that if we want to conquer lust, lust means plan making to enjoy the world. So if you want to conquer lust, make plans as to how to preach Krishna consciousness. And it is very engaging for our mind. Especially if we find it difficult at whatever stage we are now to engage our mind directly in Krishna's non-rupa guna lila, if that's really a struggle for us, we can engage our mind in plans to spread Krishna consciousness. Now, we should come to the point where we can engage our mind in Krishna's non-guna rupa lila. We don't want to stay just on the platform that we just engage our minds in plans for preaching. And one leader told me, I'm very conscious of Krishna consciousness, but not very conscious of Krishna. So we want to become conscious of Krishna. But if we take responsibility in Lord Chaitanya's movement, it's a very good thing as far as engaging our mind. And it helps align us with the plan of the Lord, if we do it in the proper consciousness. Now, just our final note here is, we mentioned already, but just to get into a little bit deeper in regard to this particular verse and purport, how Krishna uses everything in his plan, even if you are a demon. And that's pretty amazing. And he integrates the activities of those who are opposed to him into his own plan. Prabhupada often talks about that if you don't want to serve the government and you become a criminal, you go to jail and then you serve the government in jail. You make license plates or whatever. You're still under the law. You don't really have a choice of being not under the law. So the people who say there's no God or I hate God or I'm going to break all the laws of God, they also facilitate the plan of God. Krishna uses them. He says, okay, you have wrath that you can't control the material world, and you think it's that person's fault, or that all of those persons' fault, all of those persons of that country, or that religion, or that race, or whatever. You think, if only I could eliminate all of the, you know, whatever, all of the purple people, and all the green people. Whatever. If I can eliminate all of those people, then I'd be able to control the world, right? And then you have a war. Krishna says, okay, you want a war because of your wrath and not being able to control. I'll put in that war all the people that I need to get rid of anyway, and then you can get rid of them. Isn't that interesting? You know, if someone's destined to die by violence, that's their karma. And there's somebody who wants to kill somebody, okay, you can kill that one. That's what they're supposed to get. You know, you can go give them, you can be the agent of their karma and work in my universal plan. Right? I mean, if you're destined to lose your money, you could lose it in many ways. But if somebody wants to steal, okay, you want to steal, this guy's destined to lose his money. You steal from him. Interesting experience. Once in Puerto Rico, that I was giving the Sunday feast class and I was talking about detachment. And you want to have equilibrium for gain and loss, victory and defeat, honor and dishonor. At that particular time in my life, I was extremely poor. Like extremely, extremely, extremely. I had a total of $100, which I had earned by helping a god sister sell cosmetics in a mall. That I didn't do that to earn money. I did that as a favor to her. She said, I lost somebody. Can you please fill in with for them? And so I did. That work was just torture. It was like, it was just like doing book distribution, except that it was selling lotion instead of books. And it was all things that nobody needed. You know, we were just selling things that nobody needed at very high prices because there were about 12 people each taking a cut, you know, of this product. And so the whole thing was very unsavory. I was really just doing it as a favor to her. But so it was it was a lot of tapasya mentally, because I didn't like the work. You understand? I didn't like the work. I didn't feel it was really honest work. I thought, when is she going to get somebody hired so I can quit? And I had earned this $100 in that very painful way. That was all that I had. And when I was giving the Sunday Feast lecture, I'd forgotten to lock my door. And the devotees had said, make sure that the Sunday Feast is locked the door. And I came back and my $100 were stolen. And I thought, well, that's what I get for preaching about detachment, the Sunday Feast. I came back, I started cracking up. I was like, okay, appreciate it. I'm sitting on the Vyasa saying, we should be detached from whether we're rich or poor, you know, gain and loss, victory, we should just have equilibrium. And Krishna's like, okay, let's see you do that. So I came back, I was like, all right, I get it. So Krishna has so many ways. If you want to be a criminal, Krishna will put you in touch with somebody who has that as their destiny. You know, if you want to do horrible things, terrible things, Krishna will put you in a situation where that terrible thing will accomplish something he wants to accomplish. So the bottom line is, forget about not working with Krishna's plan. We're always working with Krishna's plan. There's no way we're out of Krishna's plan. No matter how much you try to be out of Krishna's plan, he'll integrate you into his plan. How he does that is absolutely, totally beyond my comprehension. I just can't even fathom it in any way, shape, or form. I used to teach multi-level in the Gurukula. I actually try to individualize. So I would have 30 kids. Everyone is doing their own program. So during mathematics class, even if two or three students are in the same mathematics book, they're in different sections. So I had 30 different math class going on at the same time. And just keeping track of that was very difficult. If I didn't have a written system, I would forget things, much to the joy of the students. Oh, good. She's managing so much, she forgot that I had a written assignment due today. So they would never remind me. Right? They would hope that it would kind of slip through the cracks. So I had to have a really together system in writing to remember what everyone was supposed to be doing and at what time and so forth. And it was a lot. It was a lot. I mean, after teaching from 9 to 2 every day, I took lunch and I went to sleep. Because my mind couldn't function after doing that. You understand? After trying to coordinate the different work of 30 people, and, you know, whatever it was, 5 or 6 subjects, all doing different things, I didn't have the mental energy to do anything. I had to sleep before I could correct papers. Now, Krishna is coordinating the activities of how many living entities at once? You know, we're all getting our karma, and everyone else is getting their karma, and somehow Krishna puts together my karma with everybody else's karma, not just for the human beings, even for the bugs. How in the world does he do that? You know, how does he coordinate this bug is destined to die now and, you know, Joe Schmo steps on the sidewalk right now? I mean, how does he do that? I haven't a clue. But figure that everything we do is already in Krishna's plan. We can never be outside of Krishna's plan. It's just not possible. It doesn't matter how hard you try. He'll say, I can use that. Bet you can't use this. Yeah, I can. This one. Oh, wait, I'm going to do so much destruction and havoc and evil. No, I can use that too. I'll work it in. Yeah, it'll fit in. Act 3, scene 5 over there. So when we want to align with Krishna's plan, it's much more a question of raising our consciousness and being a willing participant in Krishna's plan. And looking about our motives for being in Krishna's plan. I really like where Bhaktivinoda says in Jiva Dharma that this material world is also one of the leelas of the Lord. He says, and if you're suffering here, it's completely your fault. Because you're just not in harmony with what's going on. You know, if everyone's singing in harmony and you're singing out of harmony, or you're singing offbeat, or you ever have a time when someone's leading the kirtan and somebody starts responding with a different tune? kind of confuses everybody, and pretty soon everybody in the room is, everybody's singing their own tune, right? It just happened to me in kirtan. I was like, what do I say? I don't know. Right? And then you're more suffering. So instead, Bhakti Vinod Thakur says, exalt in the leelas of the Lord and joyfully participate in the leelas of the Lord. Nice letter Prabhupada wrote to Jayapataka Swami. He said, surrender to Krishna means whatever is meant to be, that I am doing, and let me do it with full dedication. A devotee recently recommended a Krishna book to me about surrender, Atmanivedana. And the point they make over and over again is, figure that whatever is happening is the will of God. And the will of God is perfect. And if you surrender to that, even if it appears to be suffering, if you surrender. And I found it fascinating that whether it's atheistic Buddhists talking about meditation, or Christians talking about surrender, or Krishna himself in the Bhagavad Gita talking about bhakti, they're all saying, if you want to be happy, stop resisting what's going on. Join what's going on, but in bhakti we're going to say, join what's going on in joy. Okay, here I am. Let me flow with you. Let me not be a rock in the river. You know, let me flow with you. Just like Rupa Goswami says in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, be the aquatics that swim in the ocean. Be the aquatics, they're not the swim deep in the ocean, they're not disturbed by what goes on in the surface. So if we do this, this is of course Atmanivedana, surrender to the Lord's plan. If we do this, then we will certainly achieve the result of sattva-guna that will always be happy and satisfied within, regardless of what happens. But we'll achieve something far more than that, that will have expansive, unlimited, transcendental ecstasy in love of God. Now, we may not necessarily achieve the result of rajaguna. We might not. I mean, Krishna does say to Arjuna that if you're a yogi, you achieve the result of jnana and karma and so forth. We may be given a great kingdom like Yudhisthira and be the king of the world, or we may just be given a little shop like Kolavicha Sridhar selling banana leaf pods. But because the devotee is happy with it, that's not of any consequence. And we will even achieve, in one sense, the result of tamaguna, that everything will be without great endeavor. We will no longer feel we have to make great endeavor. And there's a nice commentary by Jiva Goswami in the Bhakti and the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, where he says, but isn't bhakti with endeavor? He says, isn't sadhana bhakti with effort? He says, no, the effort the devotee make is all soft. It's all soft-heartedness. The devotee never makes some hard endeavor like in Vajrayana. So thank you very much. There was so much in this purport. Maybe we could have talked about just each sentence in this purport. It was so deep. It was really hard to think of what to... How to focus the question. Yes,
Prabhu. In Bhagavad Gita, we said Krishna says the merger is completed.
Yes.
And we also see that often as devotees, we're not on that transcendental platform. You know, sometimes we're in the service.
Yes.
Even unfortunately, sometimes we're in the mode of ignorance. So can you say something about how, you know, it's often within ourselves, that competition is going on.
Mm.
How we can bring ourselves or try to endeavor to come to that, at least at that sattva-guna platform.
Okay, well, this is fifth chapter, can't remember the verse, 13, I think it's verse 30, and chapter 14, text 22 to 25. So in the fifth chapter, Krishna says, while you're doing all the things in the world, actually you're doing nothing, you're an observer. And he says almost the identical thing in 13, pretty sure it's text 30. That the soul is doing nothing, the soul is an observer. Then in 14, 22, 25, this is Krishna's answer to Arjuna, that what is it, how do you go above the modes, and what does that look like? And Krishna says, one who does not hate illumination, attachment, or delusion when they appear, nor long for them when they disappear, who sees that the modes alone are active, who always remains neutral. So this is the idea that we are the observer. Now, all spiritual and religious traditions aim for this in their original form. Of course, a lot of traditions end up going down to sattva-guna and even rajaguna. Most religions in the world today are preaching rajaguna. Be a good person in the world by God's grace.
some priests, sattva-gun, come to equanimity. Right? But they all teach this. I mean, there's a particular branch of Buddhism meditation, vipassana, that's aimed simply and only at getting yourself to be an observer of the modes in your body and mind. You know, what they do, I was talking to a devotee who had gone to the Himalayas and engaged in a one-week vipassana meditation retreat, which didn't sound, after he described it, like anything I would ever want to do. But he said that what they do is they just constantly scan their body and their mind. What's happening in the body, what's happening in the mind, what's happening. For like 10 hours a day. Just scanning, 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 scanning. Until they become an observer. I ended up experiencing this without knowing I was going to experience this. When I was in labor with my second child, when I was pregnant with my second child, I read in Prabhupada's Seven Teachings of Lord Kapila, where he says a person can put his mind in such a way that he won't be disturbed by a surgical operation. And he gave the example of stone. And he said, you know, and I thought, well, you know, if a demon can do it, I'm supposed to be a devotee. And so I practiced every day for many months during the pregnancy, where I would just meditate on Radha Govinda. I was in New York. And I was meditating on Govinda's belt. I mean, it was very large piece, actually kind of gaudy. It was kind of ugly piece of jewelry. But very large. It was easy to meditate on because it was so big, and I must admit, it wasn't very attractive. It looked pretty on Govinda, but off Govinda, you look at it, you know, and had three strands that all met in the middle and then strands that came down. So I just meditated on Govinda's belt and practiced that. And then during the labor, I was doing the same thing. And I just told myself, as long as I'm meditating like this, there's nothing that will disturb me. I was basically, mentally, I was in the temple room. And I didn't expect this to happen. I became the observer of what was in my body. It's like, oh, my muscles are contracting like this. Oh, that's interesting. That was how I experienced it. I felt some sensation, but the sensation didn't have any pain attached to it. It had zero pain attached to it. And I was actually more aware of what was happening with my internal organs, which will normally have no awareness of at all, than I would have been in pain. When you're in pain, you just feel the pain, you understand? And you don't really understand what's happening. But when that was removed, I could understand every detail. I was aware of blood going through my head. It was like an incredible experience. But it was just sort of, well, that's interesting. I'm here with Radha Govinda. That's kind of interesting. Yeah. It was something in the background that was sort of fascinating, that, how the Lord's material energy works is just kind of interesting. Do you follow me? Does that make sense? But it wasn't, my attention was Radha Govinda. Oh, there's some interesting thing happening with the material energy over there. And it was an incredible, absolutely incredible experience. So that's what we do, as Krishna says, Bhamcha Yoga Vicharana Bhakti Yoga Sevati Sabinat Samati Chaitan Bhavaburaya Kapati. If we're always serving Krishna, then what's happening in the modes of material nature is just, oh, those are the modes of material nature. Oh, look at that. Right now my mind is in sattva-gun. It's all illuminated and peaceful and, oh, okay, that's interesting. Okay, I have some service to do for Krishna. Oh, look at that. Right now my mind's in Rajagun. You need this, you need that, you should get that, you should get that, and you have to get that. And this person insulted you. Didn't you notice that? Oh, that's interesting. Hi, Rajagun. Yeah, I'm serving Krishna. And right now my mind's in Tamagun. Oh, I'm so bad, I'm so terrible. I'm never going to attend Krishna. I'm just so full. Life is so hard. Why do I do bhakti anyway? It never works. Everybody hates me. Oh, that's interesting. That's tamagun. Hi, tamagun. I'm going to do my service for Krishna. You become the observer. What does Krishna say? You know, it's so fascinating. In the second chapter, what is it, 263, where Krishna gives the fall down sequence. He says there's something out there, and what do? You contemplate. Attached, then you're angry, then you're bewildered. So we just feel bewildered. Oh God, I'm bewildered by Rajagun, I'm bewildered by Sattvagun, I'm bewildered by Tamagun. How did I get bewildered? You contemplate it. You contemplate it. you got lusty, you got angry, you lost your intelligence. But we didn't see the steps. We're just like bewildered. So how do you see the steps? How do you see the thought, the impression, the feeling? How do you become aware of that? And you're aware of a gap between that thing, that sense object, which can also be a mental object, the mind is a sense, that sense object and contemplation. You become aware of this gap. And you never contemplate. You never let it get to the contemplation stage because you're aware of that gap. And then you never get to the bewilderment. How do you become aware of that gap? So what does Krishna say in the next verses? 64, 65. He talks about just being the observer. Now, how do you just be the observer? You could do that through Gyan Yoga, or Dhyan Yoga, which is what like the Buddhists do. That's what they're doing. Or you could do it through Bhakti. How do you do it through Bhakti? You get absorbed in Krishna. You get a positive absorption in Krishna. You contemplate Krishna. You get attached to Krishna. You intentionally want Krishna. All those things that we would do for the sense of men, you do that for Krishna. And then when the sense objects, and that includes a mental object, a thought, when those things come into the picture, when they kind of come into the peripheral vision, you have some awareness of them. It's not that you have no awareness of them, otherwise you couldn't function in the world. Otherwise, you know, you'd be in the kind of samadhi of Samagarishi where he didn't even hear Maharaj Parikit, so, which is also okay. It is, I know. Bhakti yogis also can get in that kind of samadhi, but you're in the kind of samadhi where the sense and mental objects, they come in and you know they're there. No. Well, Krishna's illusory energy is interesting. Okay. And it's like a river that flows into the ocean. Just to do that, you have to neither grasp it nor push it. Now, we devotees know we're not supposed to grasp it. We know that. But we don't understand that we're not supposed to push it. And I see many devotees who just fail to make progress because they're putting all their energy into pushing. Instead of putting their energy into meditating on Krishna and neither grasping nor pushing, they're putting their energy into pushing, which is not any kind of yoga. That isn't even Gyan Yoga. Even the Gyanis don't push away. You follow? The Gyani works at intellectually, philosophically becoming the observer. The Dhyan Yogi works at becoming the observer through manipulating the breath and so forth. The Karma Yogi works at becoming the observer by taking all their fruits, and when they're ready, when they would enjoy it, they give it away to the Lord. And they give away their, you know, you work hard for a fruit, and then you give it away. You work hard for a fruit, and you give it away. You work hard for a fruit, and then you give it away. That would make you an observer, wouldn't it? That would give you detachment, as Krishna says. Karma Palatyaga brings shanti in the 12th chapter. So our process of becoming the observer is to become absorbed in the reality. It's kind of like I gave this example all the time. You walk from an electronics store, they're selling televisions, they're showing something on the television. You may see that it's there. You may see somebody's getting shot to death on the television in the movie. But you're with your friend. You have a relationship with your friend, and you're not buying the television. So you're not affected by it. But you don't go smash the television. You follow? You don't walk into a, you know, electronics store. That's not how you deal with it. You basically ignore it. You have your mission that you're there for. And you know, somebody shooting somebody. Okay, I'm going on. So people, I see that it's a very big mistake that devotees think the way that to conquer Maya and to conquer the mind means that what I do is I push away and I'm averse to and I reject all the negative thoughts, all the negative feelings, all the negative desires. And the problem is then we are negatively contemplating them, which has exactly the same effect as positively grasping them. Exactly. It leads to lust and anger and bewilderment. except that we can't figure out why. We're like, I didn't grasp this, I pushed it away. Why is it bewildering me? Then we're doubly bewildered. You know, we can understand why if I actually do the thing, I would get bewildered. That makes sense to me. But if I'm putting all my energy into pushing it away, why am I bewildered? Is that all right? Yes.
I'm regarding the point about how Krishna engages everybody.
Yeah.
Those who want to do something else.
Uh-huh.
So now thinking as, in terms of someone's practicing devotional service, and then where we're dealing with our vices, and it can be anything from level of regulative principles to something very subtle. So then we try, you know, to overcome these vices, obviously, but then we also fail at times. So then how does one then understand that with that perspective?
Does Krishna use our failing in bhakti in his plan? Of course he does. That doesn't mean he wants you to fail in bhakti. Okay. It's not that Krishna wants a murderer to murder. Otherwise the murderer wouldn't get bad karma for murdering. You know, if person A is destined to die a violent death, Krishna doesn't need person B to murder person A to accomplish that. There's all kinds of ways you could die a violent death without being murdered. Right? So, it's not that Krishna wants you to fall down from your bhakti, either subtly or grossly, to facilitate his plan. I mean, if you're a pure devotee, he may engage you like Yudhisthira, like the others. But for someone who's a sadhaka, that's not what's going on. So we can understand that Krishna says, all right, you messed up, let's make some lemonade out of the lemons. At least you can learn something from it. Sometimes Krishna also uses you as a bad example for others not to follow. Seriously.
Because at some stage, you know, I think probably every sadhaka will get to a point where they get into a cycle with a particular vice or a negative pattern.
Yes.
And that can continue for a very long time.
It can continue for many lifetimes.
Yeah. So then also in terms of that, then how does one then actually know?
That's like a Bhoga Tyaga cycle. It's somebody stuck in Bhoga Tyaga, and they think when they're in the Tyaga phase, they're Krishna conscious. Mm-hmm. Is what that is. It's a very simple Bhoga Tyaga thing. We'll talk in Manushiksha about overcoming gross and subtle vices, especially tomorrow, a little bit today. There's 4 verses in Manushiksha about overcoming gross and subtle vices. And hopefully we'll do the first one tonight, and then we'll do the other 3 tomorrow night. So I'll wait and get into there. But when someone's stuck in a cycle with a vice, pretty much, generally, you're looking at just a regular material Bhoga Tyaga situation. Generally, that's what you're looking at. And, you know, in order to enjoy anything, you have to get away from it for a while. Because anything you enjoy on the sensual or mental platform gets boring. And if you do it a lot, it gets actually repulsive. You know, so if you do something too much, it becomes boring. Then if you do it more, it becomes repulsive. So intelligent materialists stop before the boring point and renounce. And then they get back into it, and before it gets boring, they renounce again. Because otherwise you don't get any kick out of the thing. You get anything we become habituated to doesn't give us any pleasure anymore. It's just like you've got these beautiful chandeliers, but if you live here, you probably don't get any pleasure from them. Because you don't even see them. They're just in your environment. You know, Cape Town is a beautiful city, but again, if you live here, you may not get pleasure out of it. It's just where we live. And somebody comes and they're saying, wow. You know, so anything that becomes habituated in our environment. You know, Krishna's Navayovanamcha. He's always fresh. It's always new. Everything about Krishna is always new. But the material, everything is actually always old. So this, you know, when I think I've conquered some vice, but then I go back to it again, and I think I've conquered, and I go back to it again, you probably haven't conquered it at all. Sorry. And so you want to look at something completely different than whatever you're doing in the renunciation stage. If your way of conquering your vice is to go to the renunciation stage, and that isn't working, then you need something completely different than what you're doing. Not just to get to, you know, people think, well, if I could get the renunciation stage to just last longer, you know, or go deeper. But if the basic principle is just the Bhoga Tyaga going on, no matter what you do, you're going to go back to it. And this is why people struggle with any kind of addiction in the world, for example. People in general struggle with this, if all they're using is the natural renunciation stage that has to happen anyway. And they mistake the natural renunciation for actual renunciation, for actual detachment. But conquering real vices so that they never come back is quite a different thing. We'll discuss this particularly with verse 6 of Manasutra, which we'll do tomorrow. Okay, we should end now because it's considerably after 9. Srila Prabhupada ki.